sure the drugs got to these generals. They each had a distribution franchise, and they'd sell the drugs in their area and make huge profits off it, which is why they supported American policy and gave the CIA a free hand. By the late 1960s, most of the drugs were going to American soldiers. By 1970, the Nixon administration was aware that thousands of soldiers were addicts and that the problem was affecting the course of the war. Veterans returned to America with their habits, and the CIA was underwriting the whole thing. I was curious about how U.S. drug law enforcement dealt with the fact that American soldiers were being addicted and that tons of drugs were pouring into the U.S. thanks to the CIA. The DEA had to be involved in this CIA drug smuggling operation, and I was determined to write a book about that. My next two books, The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack, focus on the corruption the CIA fosters within U.S. law enforcement. Those books are about the role the federal drug agencies play in protecting the CIA and its drug smuggling assets. I did interviews with agents, and I provide a lot of documentation. Most of that material is archived at the National Security Archives. The books also show how the drug law enforcement agencies make sure drugs get to despised minorities, people our rulers want to see in prison and politically disenfranchised. I show how drug law enforcement serves the national security function of making sure the right people get the drugs. Essential to this arrangement is the CIA's accommodation with organized crime. The gangsters are allowed to import and distribute the drugs in the major cities in exchange for telling drug agents which street dealers they're supplying. The hoods get rich by informing, and when the CIA has no more use for them, they're discarded like the generals in Vietnam. Dawson, let's talk about plausible deniability. Valentine, the CIA doesn't do anything it can't deny. A senior CIA officer named Tom Donahue told me about this. Colby introduced me to Donahue, and he was very forthcoming. Some of the guys Colby referred me to were hoping for the opportunity to tell their stories. It has to do with grandiosity. There's no point doing dangerous things unless the guys talk about your heroics in saloons. They saw me as a chance to memorialize themselves as heroes. But in the process, they had to explain a bit about how the CIA works. If not sources, at least its methods. Donahue was a prime example. He'd studied comparative religion at Columbia University and understood symbolic transformation. He was a product and practitioner of Cook County politics who joined the CIA after World War II when he perceived the Cold War as a growth industry. He'd been the CIA's station chief in the Philippines at the end of his career. And when I spoke to him, he was in business with a former Filipino defense minister. He was putting his contacts to good use, which is par for the course. It's how corruption works for senior bureaucrats. Donahue said the CIA doesn't do anything unless it meets two criteria. The first criterion is intelligence potential. The program must benefit the CIA. Maybe it tells them how to overthrow a government, or how to blackmail an official, or where the report is hidden, or how to get an agent across a border. The euphemism, intelligence potential, means it has some use for the CIA. The second criterion is that it can be denied. If they can't find a way to set it up so they can deny it, they won't do it. Most everything the CIA does is deniable. It's part of their congressional mandate. Congress doesn't want to be held accountable for the criminal things the CIA does. The only time something the CIA does becomes public knowledge, other than the occasional accident or whistleblower, is when Congress or the President think it's helpful for propaganda reasons to let people know the CIA is doing this. Torture is a good example. After 9/11, and up until and through the invasion of Iraq, the American people wanted revenge. They wanted to see Muslim blood flowing. So the Bush administration let it leak that they were torturing evildoers. They played it cute and called it enhanced interrogation, but everyone understood symbolically. Dawson, they may have tortured people for 4 years. Valentine, they've always tortured people. Look at slavery. In America, the bosses cover it up, which goes back to what I was telling you at the beginning. If you visit Thomas Jefferson's estate at Monticello, You won't see the slave quarters. It's a cover-up, like the Hotel Tacloban. But unfortunately, many people like it that way. They prefer not to know. They prefer a poster with a happy cliché on it. If we all join hands and drink Pepsi, there will be peace in the world. Like any other kind of advertising, propaganda is meant to delude, not inform. But it's better to face the facts. While I was researching Phoenix, I found out about the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking. I also learned that as the Vietnam War was winding down, the CIA started reducing the number of officers serving in Laos and Vietnam. The CIA felt it had the situation under control there and was looking for new homes for these guys. I discovered that over 100 officers were funneled into the BNDD and DEA. These recycled CIA officers had been involved in Phoenix and associated programs, and I wondered, why are they going into the DEA? And who are they really working for? One of my CIA contacts was a fascinating man named Tully Acampora. Tully was a World War II veteran who started working for the CIA in Korea and ended up being detached to the CIA for most of his career. In Vietnam, starting in 1966, he was General Nguyen Ngoc Lon's advisor. Lon was famous as the guy who was photographed shooting a VC guerrilla in the head during the Tet Offensive in 1968. Al McCoy described Lon at length in The Politics of Heroin. Lon, McCoy explained, was Air Marshal Nguyen Cao Ky's deputy. After Ky was appointed premier in July 1965, he appointed Lon to head the National Police, the Military Security Service, and the Central Intelligence Organization. Lon established and managed Ky's political machine by using systematic corruption to combat urban guerrilla warfare. Corruption financed cash rewards for agents. Lon systematized the corruption, regulating how much each particular agency would collect, how much each officer would skim off for his personal use, and what percentage would be turned over to Ky's political machine. As McCoy noted, the opium traffic was undeniably the most important source of illicit revenue. And my friend Tully was Lone's CIA advisor until 1968, until the CIA decided to replace Ky's political machine with one under President Nguyen Van Thieu. Tully was one of the people that started funneling CIA officers into the DEA in the early 1970s. I don't want to bore you with details, but it's important to know why he was in position to do that. From 1958 until 1965, Tully worked for the CIA in Italy, and while he was there, he became close friends with three federal narcotics agents stationed in Rome. They were agents in the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, FBM. They were Italian-Americans, like Tully, and were making cases on the Mafia and its associates throughout Europe and the Middle East. Tully formed friendships with FBN agents Charlie Siragusa, Hank Manfredi, and Andy Tartolino. Siragusa was the boss. He'd been in the OSS and had worked with James Jesus Angleton in Italy during World War II. As chief of counterintelligence in the CIA, Angleton became dependent on Siragusa for his mafia contacts. You might have wondered how it is that the CIA can reach into the underworld and compel mobsters to do its dirty work, like the assassination attempts on Castro. Well, the CIA often does it through senior law enforcement officials like Charlie Siragusa. According to Tully, Angleton kissed Siragusa's ass in Macy's window at noon. Hank Manfredi had been in the Army CID in World War II and was actually a CIA officer working under FBN cover. He spent his entire career in Italy until 1968, when he had a crippling heart attack and returned to the U.S. The FBN had been reformed as the BNDD by then, and Andy Tartolino was one of its deputy directors. Tartolino arranged for Manfredi to join the BNDD first as an inspector and later as a manager in its foreign operations division. Siragusa and Manfredi were no longer alive when I started researching the CIA and the DEA, but Tartolino was. I told Tully that I want to learn about the CIA's involvement in drug trafficking, and he sent me to Andy. Andy became the DEA's Deputy Director of Administration when the organization was formed in 1973. He was one of the most knowledgeable guys about how the CIA corrupted federal law enforcement. So meeting Andy was like meeting Colby. I now had an entree into the highest levels of the DEA. Tully sent me to Andy, and Andy said, "Okay, I'll talk to you as a favor for Tully, but first you have to start at the beginning with the Bureau of Narcotics. Spend a year, talk to as many people as you can, and then come back and I'll talk to you." That's what I did, and it was amazing what I found out. Tartalino had led a corruption investigation that lasted from 1965 to 1968. It resulted in 32 agents having to resign for committing all manner of crimes. 27 informants had been murdered, allegedly by FBN agents. None of the agents were prosecuted for those murders, but the ones who were suspected were allowed to resign. It was a cover-up, like happened at the Hotel Tacloban POW camp. 4 or 5 agents were indicted for other crimes, and in 1968 the Bureau of Narcotics was taken out of Treasury and put in the Justice Department. It was merged with other agencies and reorganized as the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, BNDD, as a result of Tartalino investigation into corruption, mostly in New York City. The media loves to talk about corruption in foreign countries, but if you want to understand corruption, you have to study the relationship between crime and law enforcement in New York City. Siragusa, Manfredi, and Acampora were from New York. I'm from the suburbs, but my mother and her Italian-American family are from the city. Frank Serpico was a cop who exposed corruption in the NYPD in the early 1970s. He was a narcotics detective and was shot in the face by fellow cops. He survived and went to the Knapp Commission and revealed the extent of corruption within the NYPD. It was tied into what happened within the FBN, and Tartalino was involved in that investigation too. It uncovered rampant corruption among judges, prosecutors, and politicians, but they covered most of that up too, because everyone involved in law enforcement depends on corruption so they can send their kids to college, move to the suburbs, and take vacations in Mexico. They don't get paid enough otherwise. But I'm getting ahead of myself. As you're probably aware, opiates were legal until 1914, when Congress passed the Harrison Narcotic Act and the federal government started to regulate opium and cocaine. The act was a tax revenue measure. People who were importing opium and coca leaves into the U.S. had to report how much they were importing so they could be taxed and the government could make some money. The government regulated how much they brought in and which companies could manufacture it. This explains how it was that the Bureau of Narcotics was first set up in the Treasury Department. Within a few years, Congress decided that it should be a law enforcement issue. It was a way of giving doctors, drug manufacturers, and pharmaceutical companies a monopoly and sending anyone else who used or sold regulated drugs to jail. They created a narcotics law enforcement agency to find out who the addicts and their suppliers were and to put them in prison. They gave narcotics agents guns. This is during Prohibition, and anyone who knows anything about Prohibition knows that a lot of booze was coming into the country in police vans, and that cops were out on the beaches protecting the gangsters, unloading the ships, and making sure the police chief got the best bottle of scotch. Prohibition was the genius invention of Congress that allowed crime to become organized under the direction of law enforcement in the United States. Dawson: "They made it the biggest black market ever." Valentine: "All of a sudden, crime becomes as big an industry as the oil industry. As Meyer Lansky famously said, we're bigger than General Motors." Dawson: "The same thing happened in Russia when they had prohibition." Valentine: "The demand was huge. So illegal drugs became a big money-making facet of our business society, and the guys smuggling booze and dope became politically powerful. People like Arnold Rothstein, the Jewish mobster who bankrolled most of the bookie operations in America. Rothstein was extorting labor organizations in New York City. He controlled the booze coming in from Canada and by ship from Europe and Asia. He had the alcohol smuggling infrastructure, so he controlled narcotics too. He had a network of Jewish gangsters working for him out of Eastern Europe and as far away as Shanghai. The first international drug smuggling network consisted of Jews who'd been relegated to certain illegal occupations, like smuggling, through discrimination. They got pushed into this business and excelled at it. Rothstein's organization ended in 1928 when the mafia and the group of younger Jewish mobsters got upset because he had a monopoly. Lucky Luciano joined forces with Meyer Lansky, and they bumped off Rothstein and divvied up his empire. They incorporated crime and started dealing with the Kuomintang Chinese. That's the original syndicate. Before there was a CIA, the U.S. government was protecting the nationalist Chinese because they were fighting communists. The government protected Kuomintang opium and heroin routes into Mexico and the U.S. West Coast, which was another boon for this drug-smuggling syndicate run by the mafia. Luciano and Lansky organized crime on the totalitarian corporate model. They set up banks and created shell companies and paid off the cops at every step of the way. That's their plausible deniability. The CIA hired some of these drug traffickers in World War II for their expertise at creating false identities, crossing borders with contraband, and eluding policemen. The mafia also controlled many unions the ruling class wanted to subvert and use for its own purposes. Hiring drug traffickers was no big deal when you consider that the military and CIA recycled a slew of Nazis like Wernher von Braun and Reinhard Gehlen and used them in the secret war against the Soviets after World War II. Dawson, they consolidated power too. They had Bugsy Siegel kick off a couple of dons. It really became a syndicate, La Cosa Nostra. Like you said, it became a real corporate enterprise. They consolidated mafia power. Valentine, believe me, it's not actually called La Cosa Nostra. That's an FBI invention. Nobody had heard the phrase until the FBI told Joe Valachi to introduce it to the public during congressional hearings in 1963. La Cosa Nostra means the our thing. That's the literal translation of La Cosa Nostra, the our thing. I'll try to explain how corruption evolves. When Rothstein was assassinated, the cops ran to his office. He lived in a suite at the Park Central Hotel, but had an office elsewhere. Unfortunately, someone else got there first and grabbed Rothstein's accounting books. Maybe that's one of the reasons he was killed. Anyway, panic ensued in New York because everyone was on his payroll. The state Republicans started an investigation that tracked back to Tammany Democrats. Republicans were running for Congress saying, "My opponent was on Rothstein's payroll, and here are the documents." Eventually, it tracked back to Republicans as well. The scandal also tracked back to the top federal narcotics agents in New York City and to Colonel Levi Nutt, who had been appointed in 1920 to run the narcotics division of the IRS Prohibition Unit. The Prohibition Unit was notoriously corrupt. It was in the Treasury Department, and Levi Nutt was in charge of its narcotics unit, and his agents were famous for being more corrupt than the Prohibition agents. The investigation of Rothstein ended up showing that narcotics investigator Levi Nutt's son-in-law was Rothstein's tax attorney. Village cops running the numbers racket with a mafia hood in the back of a bread truck is corruption 101. The PhD-level course is the son-in-law of the chief of the narcotics division writing tax returns for the world's biggest drug smuggler. One narcotics agent told me there wasn't a drug deal that went down in Chicago in the 40s and 50s that didn't go through the cops to the politicians. That's still the case today, except they've gotten better at disguising it. They're able to hide the CIA's $50 billion budget. They're better at fooling the public, too, so you'd never in your wildest dreams think that your protectors are dealing with the people preying upon you. But that is a fact, and that accommodation between crime and law enforcement is the glue that holds the system together. Their most egregious crime is the systematic falsification of history. What starts out as an agent padding reports becomes, when all those reports are assembled, the myth of the cop or soldier or CIA agent as hero. FBN agent Frankie Waters explained it to me. "One of my talents was testifying in court," Waters said. "It was a situation that terrified me at first, But then I did it a few times and realized I liked it, because it fueled all the grandiose ideas I had about myself. And I was good at it. I could testify about a case made in Chicago. Walter smiled exuberantly. They called us pinch hitters. It didn't matter that some agents couldn't testify well, Waters added, especially in big cases where 20 agents were involved. Say Agent Joe Blow seizes the most crucial piece of evidence, a note that's essential for the jury to understand the case. Joe's a great agent, but he freezes if he has to speak in front of a crowd. A block away is his articulate partner. I'm the case agent to whom they both submit their memos. So when I write up the final report, guess who sees the note? As a way of justifying the systematic falsification of reports, Waters evoked the myth of the seasoned investigator who must bend the rules to get the bad guys. There's a bigger picture you've got to see, he stressed. There was a war between good and evil, and we were losing it. And it seemed that when justice triumphed, it was by accident. So let me tell you about integrity. On the one hand, you had the critics who couldn't make cases for moral reasons or because they were inept. On the other hand were the case makers, who knew we had to be the superior force because the only thing that kept the criminals from overrunning us was that they knew that our goon squad would wipe out their neighborhood if they tried. To show success to the politicians who control their budgets, top managers in every bureaucracy rely on fictionalized reporting. The essential fictions, like the need to bend the rules, are taught to new agents. The agents must learn them by heart to advance. Over time, the agents come to believe the fictions, which reinforce all their false assumptions about society and their role in it. For example, black agents in the FBN weren't allowed to supervise whites. The bosses said the blacks couldn't write well enough because in their reports they didn't ascribe to the fiction of white supremacy. Not until 1968 was a black agent made a group leader in the FBN. The organization, like American society in general and its security services in particular, accepted white superiority as gospel, and compulsory belief in that gospel paved the way for the political cadre at the top of the organizations to propagate other myths, like the myth that the communist Chinese were pushing drugs on Americans as a kind of psychological warfare, and the myth that pot was as dangerous as heroin. The most important fiction of all is the need for secrecy to preserve our national security. From time to time, that is true, but far more often, officials use secrecy to conceal their corruption and crimes. So Levi Nutt was shuffled off to Buffalo and given a sinecure job in upstate New York. And then the political bosses hired Harry Anslinger to run the Bureau of Narcotics, which was formed in 1930. Anslinger became the commissioner of the FBN when it was created. His job was to clean up corruption, and one way he did it was to limit the inspections staff. There were approximately 300 agents in the FBN around the country, and Anslinger had only two inspectors on his staff, one for agents east of the Mississippi River and one for agents west of it. Periodically, they hopped on a train and visited offices around the country and made sure nobody was getting exposed in the newspapers for being corrupt. The corruption, obviously, continued apace. I met agents who had been in the FBN in the late 1930s. Most of the FBN agents I interviewed had joined after World War II. These were the people Andy Tartolino introduced me to, old agents who knew how things really worked. If anyone out there wants to know all the details, read my books, The Strength of the Wolf and The Strength of the Pack. Tartolino, however, only introduced me to the straight agents who had worked with him trying to root out corruption. I soon realized that was not how I was going to get the story, but through Tartolino and his clique, I knew who the corrupt agents were, so I went to them and presented them with a deal. These were the case-making agents Frankie Waters talked about, the guys who brought down the mafia and its French connection. These guys had no fear and no ethics, and that's why the first book is called The Strength of the Wolf. I went to this group of agents, maybe 10 of them, and told them individually what I wanted to do. I told them the story about my father and the bread truck, and what I knew about the CIA. I promised I wouldn't link them to any murders or felonies. And on that basis, they agreed to talk to me. They talked about how they went about making cases. So if you want to understand the situation from their point of view, read the books. I can't explain it all to you in an hour, but I'll try to summarize it. Narcotics agents are agent provocateurs. They create a crime by setting up a series of undercover buys, which they do largely through informants who get paid or otherwise compensated for buying or selling drugs to people the agents bust. The best undercover agents would shoot heroin so they could pose as addicts and traffickers. These guys would do anything. But they had to provide heroin to their informants. An agent wasn't looking to cure an addict. He was looking to use an addict as an informant and sustain his habit while working up the ladder to his or her supplier. So the agents became suppliers of heroin. They became an instrumental part of the problem at the basic level, and that's still the case today, but on a grander scale. Agents are in the illicit narcotic business in both an official and unofficial capacity. Within the old FBN, a certain amount of illicit drug distribution was officially allowed. But behind the scenes, the case-making agents were competing with each other to make cases. In New York City, there were 5 groups of agents, maybe 10 agents in a group, and they were all trying to get promoted so they didn't have to be street agents forever, so they could become the bosses. Ideally, an ambitious agent latched onto an informant who could make a big case on a member of the mafia. Doing that guaranteed a successful career. But the competition was fierce, and sometimes an ambitious agent in one group would intentionally arrest another agent's informant for dealing junk. One case-making agent would subvert another case-making agent, and now you have life-and-death conflict between wolves. This is how informants ended up getting killed. The agents started bumping off each other's informants, and then each other. They killed each other. This was what got Andy Tartolino so upset. Agents were giving other agents hot shots. They'd slip heroin into someone's beer or tie him down and give him an injection of heroin and kill him. There were instances of this happening. So that's the level of corruption that permeated drug law enforcement. Without centralized control, it was a Hobbesian war. To make big cases, case-making agents needed to acquire heroin unofficially. They knew where the big dealers kept their stash, so they would burglarize an apartment and steal the drugs. They would cut the dope and resell it through their informants, share the profits, and make more cases. If they didn't get caught, they got promoted and became the bosses. Agents were raping women. A lot of addict informants were prostitutes, and the corrupt agents would force them to have sex to avoid going to jail. Agents were stealing money from floating crap games and gamblers. They were ripping off everybody, left and right. They were murdering people. So the FBN was dissolved in 1968 and reformed as the BNDD in the Justice Department. John Ingersoll, who had been chief of the Charlotte, North Carolina Police Department, became the director of the BNDD. The Johnson administration charged him with eliminating corruption, and the first thing Ingersoll did was ask CIA Director Richard Helms for help. Ingersoll told Helms that the senior managers of the BNDD, most of whom were former FBN agents, were still up to their eyeballs in corruption. The BNDD had 16 regional offices, and most were headed by a former FBN agent, and Ingersoll was worried they were spreading corruption throughout this new organization. Helms exploited the situation. He wanted to take over federal drug law enforcement, so he slipped a group of CIA officers into the BNDD, ostensibly to investigate the corrupt bosses. This actually made it into the 1975 Rockefeller Commission report about illegal domestic CIA operations. It's worth reading the 2 pages they devoted to this. I wrote an article about it called Operation Twofold. The CIA infiltrated around 20 officers into the BNDD. Each of these guys was given a job in a region. They were put in proximity to the regional boss and told to spy on him. Ingersoll thought the CIA was doing him a favor, which was very naive because the CIA used this secret program for its own nefarious purposes. You know the old adage about the camel that put its nose in the tent? Pretty soon the whole camel is inside. That applies here, and pretty soon the CIA had taken over certain facets of the BNDD. It was 1970, and people like Al McCoy were becoming aware of the CIA's drug connections in Southeast Asia. The CIA had to protect its drug smuggling operations in Vietnam or risk losing the war. It was not like the 50s and 60s. Press people were flying all over the world. They weren't taking boats anymore. They could communicate faster and learn things they didn't know before. Suddenly, the monstrous things the CIA had done for 20 years were in danger of being exposed. For 20 years, the CIA had been working with the criminal underworlds in every nation, doing exactly what the old narcotic agents did, creating crimes and covering them up. That's why the CIA wanted to commandeer federal drug law enforcement. Through Operation Twofold, the CIA infiltrated the BNDD's inspections staff and intelligence division. It created and staffed the BNDD's Office of Special Operations. It took over the BNDD's foreign operations and executive management staffs, and it still runs them today within the DEA. Dawson, the U.S. was getting opium from Afghanistan? Valentine, when the United States took over drug law enforcement in Afghanistan, opium production increased dramatically. All of a sudden, Afghan heroin is flooding the U.S. and Europe. It still is. You can say it's a coincidence, except all the opium warlords are on the CIA payroll. The DEA sends 600 agents to Afghanistan to make sure that nobody knows about it. Dawson, it's important to show what the money finances. It's more than personal profit. They use that black market money from the drugs to get into other shenanigans, supporting rent-a-terrorist groups. Valentine, the CIA is the most corrupting influence in the United States. It corrupted the Customs Bureau the same way it corrupted the DEA. It corrupts the State Department and the military. It has infiltrated civil organizations and the media to make sure that none of its illegal operations are exposed. Many CIA officers spent their careers posing as federal narcotics agents. Dawson, they're the managerial arm of the cartel. Valentine, it's the untold part of the Gary Webb story. Where the hell was the DEA? Well, the DEA was making sure no one made a case against CIA drug dealers. They make sure the drugs go to the black and Latino communities. In my opinion, that's the national security establishment's deepest, darkest secret. Exposing it was what got Webb in trouble, not a few inaccuracies in his reporting. The media's job is to bury stories about corruption, whether it's in Congress, law enforcement, or the CIA. It sticks to the fictionalized script and spreads disinformation about how things are organized and how they operate. They do it by telling the story in a certain way, just like Frankie Waters described how the FBN group leaders wrote reports. The DEA has a public affairs branch staffed by creative writers who filter out anything bad and tell you only what the bosses want you to know. The media echoes what the DEA and CIA PR people say, but it's a big lie, and it's pervasive. Part 1. The CIA's Phoenix Program in Vietnam, a template for systemic domination. The secret dominates this world, and first and foremost, as the secret of domination. Guy Debord comments on the society of the spectacle. Chapter 3. The Vietnam War's Silver Lining, a bureaucratic model for population control, emerges. The CIA's Phoenix program changed how America fights its wars and how the public views this new type of political and psychological warfare in which civilian casualties are an explicit objective. The CIA created Phoenix in Saigon in 1967 to neutralize the leaders and supporters of the communist-led insurgency in South Vietnam. referred to by the CIA as the Viet Cong Infrastructure, VCI, the targets were civilians who were working at regular jobs while secretly engaged in administrative and support functions for the armed guerrillas. These people were patriots resisting foreign aggression and seeking to take back their country, but they were considered spies and terrorists. American officials wrote laws that allowed U.S. military forces to detain, torture, and kill them by every means possible, including B-52 raids, battalion-sized cordon and search operations, and death squads. Phoenix was originally called ISEC's side for intelligence coordination and exploitation, screening, interrogation, and detention of the enemy. But the name was quickly changed for symbolic purposes. In time, the mere mention of Phoenix, the omnipotent bird of prey with a black list in one claw and a snake in the other, was enough to terrorize not only targeted members of the VCI, but the entire civilian population. Phoenix evolved from a rifle-shot approach to neutralize enemy leaders into a program of systematic repression for the political control of the South Vietnamese people. It sought to accomplish this through a highly bureaucratized system of disposing of people who could not be ideologically assimilated. The CIA found a legal basis for the program in emergency decrees and administrative detention laws that enabled American advisors to detain, torture, and kill national security offenders, as the VCI were legally referred to, without due process. The program was implemented over the objections of Government of Vietnam, GVN, officials who understood that it undermined their national sovereignty. Within this extra-legal judicial system, with its Stalinist security committees, a member of the VCI was anyone who didn't actively support the government. To be neutral or advocate for peace was viewed as supporting terrorism. Proof wasn't required, just the word of an anonymous informer. The psychological warfare aspect of Phoenix was so pervasive that people had to watch every word they said. Advocating peace with the communists was punishable by imprisonment without trial for 2 years or even death under the administrative detention laws. And the threat of being detained was a boondoggle for corrupt officials and professional criminals on the CIA payroll. Persons arrested as VCI suspects or sympathizers were released only when their families scraped together enough money to bribe the local security committee members. As a result, CIA officer Lucien Conin described Phoenix as the greatest blackmail scheme ever invented. "If you don't do what I want, you're VC." Modeled by its creator, Nelson Brigham, on Ford Motor Company's command post structure, Phoenix concentrated power in a chief executive officer and an operating committee at the top of the embassy's organizational chart. The chief executive position, the Deputy for Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development, oversaw the Phoenix Directorate in Saigon. The directorate was headed by a CIA officer supported by a statistical reporting unit, which assigned a quota of 1,800 neutralizations a month to the Phoenix coordinators who ran the program in the field. But Phoenix was a CIA program, and deniability was one of its main objectives. So the CIA left gaping holes in its safety net in order to facilitate the systematic corruption that ensured the program's true but unstated objective of terrifying the entire civilian population into submission. As CIA officer Frank Snepp wrote in Decent Interval, "The Phoenix strike teams opted for a scattershot approach, picking up anyone who might be a suspect, and eventually, when the jails were packed to overflowing, they began simply taking the law, such as it was, into their own hands." The program existed in relative secrecy until June 1969, when numerous South Vietnamese legislators complained in open session about Phoenix abuses. Everyone knew that thousands of innocent people were being extorted, jailed, and killed, but the complicit American press corps never reported it. And in the absence of any objection by the American public, the CIA had no reason to relent. It was not until late 1970, when a handful of anti-war Phoenix veterans exposed the program's many abuses, that Congress finally launched an investigation. But even then, thanks to skillful dissembling on the part of William Colby, the erstwhile deputy for civil operations and revolutionary development in charge of Phoenix, the CIA was able to shirk any responsibility. At congressional hearings into Phoenix in 1971, Representative Ogden Reed, Democrat New York, asked Colby, "Do you state categorically that Phoenix has never perpetrated the premeditated killing of a civilian in a non-combat situation?" Conflating stated policy with operational reality, the master of doublespeak replied, "Phoenix as a program has never done that. Individual members of it may have done it, but as a program, it is not designed to do that." Colby, to put it mildly, lied. In actuality, the Phoenix program was designed to be mismanaged, to open the door to and incentivize bribery, corruption, and terror as an unstated policy lever for ensuring domination over the Vietnamese population. The other side of the story. Censorship of opposing narratives is one of the main mechanisms for controlling information. Americans rarely get to hear the other side of the story, especially during a war. But in late 1970 and early 1971, a Vietnamese reporter named Dinh Duong An wrote a series of articles titled "The Truth About Phoenix" for the newspaper Tin Sang, Morning News. Tin Sang was published in Saigon by Ngo Cong Duc, a member of the Vietnamese legislature. Half of Tin Sang's issues about Phoenix were confiscated by the secret police on orders from the Minister of Information, Truong Bu Diem, a CIA asset. An knew from personal experience what he was writing about. He'd been a translator for Major Oscar L. Jenkins, one of the CIA's special police advisors running Phoenix operations in the Mekong Delta in 1968 and 1969. Phoenix, wrote An, is a series of big continuous operations which, because of the bombing, destroy the countryside and put innocent people to death. In the sky are armed helicopters, but on the ground are the black uniforms, doing what they want where the helicopters and B-52s do not reach. Americans in black uniforms, according to An, are the most terrible. The black uniforms were members of American hunter-killer teams. The hunter team was a four-man unit, usually all Americans, sometimes with one or two Vietnamese, Cambodian, or Chinese mercenaries, called counter-terrorists, CTs for short. According to An, the CIA would send the hunter teams into a village the day before a Phoenix cordon search operation to map out the village and capture people targeted for interrogation. The next day, the CTs would return in black choppers with the killer team, usually 12 to 25 South Vietnamese special forces or rangers led by Green Berets. "When they go back to their base," An said, "they bring people's bleeding ears. But are these the ears of the VC?" CIA officials like Colby did their best to narrowly define Phoenix as a perfectly legal program targeting specific individuals. But like Snep explained, and as An alluded to above, everyone was caught up in the dragnet, including and especially those who were perfectly innocent. The original purpose of Phoenix, An said, was to avenge what the VC did during Tet, which is why President Thieu did not hesitate to sign Phoenix into law. But, he added, local officials, including the legislators who complained in 1969, knew nothing about the program except the decree. The central government didn't explain anything. Furthermore, the CIA and their assistants had a hard time trying to explain to province chiefs about operations to pacify the countryside and destroy the VC. Indeed, bombing villages and spraying fields with the toxic defoliant Agent Orange served only to kill, maim, and impoverish rural villagers. And despite the avalanche of American propaganda telling the villagers such operations were done for their protection, the rural population understood that such indiscriminate attacks were directed at them, not at a few specific VCI. By 1969, they also understood that American money and bribes prolonged the war as a means of preventing any coalition government being formed with the communists. They knew from firsthand experience that powerful South Vietnamese officials profited from the carnage. that corrupt province chiefs reported the damage to their American advisors, ostensibly to get compensation for those hurt in the attacks, but kept the money for themselves. The Americans knew their counterpart officials in the government of Vietnam, GVN, were keeping the blood money, but they wanted it that way. The Americans used those officials as straw dogs and blamed them for the problems they had created. It's the same patronage system that America imposes on any nation it wishes to control. In Vietnam, the patronage system enabled the CIA to maintain the illusion, pushed upon the American public by the complicit press corps, that it cared for the Vietnamese people and wanted to protect them, while assuring, through massive corruption, its freedom to pound them into submission, and, of course, traffic in narcotics. The result was a total lack of trust in the GVN, not in the VCI. As An noted, the rural Vietnamese wondered how Phoenix could turn things around, the same way average Syrians, Iraqis, and Afghanis wonder how relentless U.S. bombing and death squad operations are helping them, as opposed to helping the corrupt warlords and government officials on the CIA payroll that authorize the bombings and death squads. Behind closed doors, CIA officials like An's American boss, the aforementioned Major Jenkins, argued that Phoenix was needed because B-52 strikes and defoliation dustings did not destroy the VCI's lower structure. This unstated policy was proof that the CIA could not reach the VCI leadership and instead opted for genocide, wiping out grassroots support for the insurgency through the blanket application of terror. In the process, An emphasized, Phoenix dragged everyone into its trap. For example, as more and more fields were destroyed by Agent Orange, people had no choice but to buy rice from Chinese merchants and smugglers. The CIA-advised special police knew this and accused them of collaborating with the VC. Naturally, the merchants and smugglers were then forced to bribe the police to keep from being arrested. This is how the CIA's patronage system of corruption turned into the greatest blackmail scheme ever invented. Anyone, including cops and soldiers, who visited family members in VC-controlled areas was put on the Phoenix blacklist and extorted by government security forces. They were surveilled, harassed, and forced to become informants in order to protect their family members from CIA hunter-killer teams and U.S. military assaults. The CIA relied heavily on false accusations to terrorize the Vietnamese. An told of five teachers working for a Catholic priest in Vinh Long province. The women refused to attend a VC indoctrination session. When the group of actual VC were captured, they named these five teachers as VC cadres. The teachers were jailed without trial or evidence. That's why people feared Phoenix, An explained. The biggest fear is being falsely accused, from which there is no protection. That's why Phoenix doesn't bring peace or security. Adding to the terror of being falsely accused, detained, tortured, and even killed, was the fact that the CIA rewarded security officials who extorted the people. The CIA, An wrote, spends money like water. Many agents from the different police in four corps receive money from the CIA, An reported, in the form of merit pay. Money was spent bribing cops on the CIA payroll with telephones, generators, air conditioners, Lambrettas, and Xerox machines. Pretty secretaries and cash awards were lavished on officials sitting on the Stalinist security committees the CIA created to prosecute national security offenders. Conveniences given to committee members, wrote An, made it easier for them to explore information from agents, leading to the arrest of more suspects and, consequently, more bribes. The corrupting effect of massive infusions of CIA money was no secret. In an interview for the Phoenix program, CIA officer Warren Milberg told me, I had virtually unlimited resources to develop agent operations, to pay for a staff that translated and produced intelligence reports. Milberg had more secret CIA money, he claimed, than what the official province budget was. While he saw this as creating economic stability, the incentive to sell false information served only to further destabilize Vietnamese society. The CIA had no way of corroborating the information it bought, but the accusations were nevertheless used to build cases against VCI suspects in order to meet neutralization quotas imposed by the Phoenix Directorate. It was a perfectly deniable facet of population control. Ahn stressed that CIA officers took no disciplinary action against officials who took bribes because the payoffs were often a vehicle for agent penetration operations into the VCI. As Ahn explained, the CIA works to keep some communist areas intact so they can get information. These types of covert intelligence operations were in direct opposition to the stated Phoenix mission of protecting the people from terrorism. Such covert operations were many and varied. Ahn noted that South Vietnamese CIA agents often posed as pharmacists or doctors. These agents would smuggle CIA-supplied medicines to VC hideouts in Cambodia in exchange for information. Phoenix, explained Ahn, was watching and talking to the VC while at the same time working to prevent the National Liberation Front from reorganizing the VCI. All of the above and more led Ahn to conclude that America was never interested in ending the war. The goal was total victory, even if many lives must be lost. Phoenix, for Ahn, was a mechanism to extend the war indefinitely with a minimum of American casualties. It was a cynical ploy used to pit the Vietnamese against each other and undermine their efforts to negotiate a peaceful settlement by fueling the conflict with money, lies, and psychological operations designed to destabilize the society. Phoenix is gone, but the method lingers on. Ironically, before Phoenix was adopted as the model for policing the American empire, many U.S. military commanders in Vietnam resisted the Phoenix strategy of targeting civilians with Einsatzgruppen-style special forces and Gestapo-style secret police. They resented the fact that military officers were being involuntarily assigned to the program. People in uniform who are pledged to abide by the Geneva Conventions, General Bruce Palmer said in a letter to me, should not be put in the position of having to break those laws of warfare. Unfortunately, the current stab-in-the-back generation of military officers, government officials, and reporters was forged on the anvil of defeat in Vietnam. This generation, which staffs the burgeoning number of Phoenix-style committees in the public and private sectors, carries the burden of restoring America's reputation for invincibility. This ruling class within the national security establishment, represented most perfectly by Hillary Clinton, knows that its enemies, foreign and domestic, must be suppressed ideologically as well as militarily. Thus, they have embraced the Phoenix concept of employing implicit and explicit terror to control, organize, and pacify societies. Phoenix was always understood as the silver lining in the Vietnam debacle. The aforementioned CIA officer, Warren Milberg, wrote a thesis in 1974 titled, The Future Applicability of the Phoenix Program. Many of the CIA and military officers I interviewed wrote similar papers extolling Phoenix. As I'll explain in greater detail in this book, Phoenix fulfilled its destiny in the wake of 9/11 and became the template for policing the empire and fighting its eternal war on terror. So successful were Phoenix operations in overthrowing the Ba'athist Party regime in Iraq that David Kilcullen, one of the U.S. government's top terrorism advisors in 2004, called for a global Phoenix program. The threat of a global Phoenix program is that it will become fully activated in the United States. If the CIA and military are successful at politically and psychologically neutralizing suspected terrorists, what is to stop them applying the full systematic extent of Phoenix-style operations to include political dissidents, immigrants, and despised minorities in America, just as they did in Vietnam? As Dinh Thuan An noted above, the program's stated policy, consumer safety, is contradicted by its operational reality. Buyer beware. This is nothing to take lightly. Security officials are adept at using doublespeak to hide repressive covert actions within intelligence operations, and they are using the exact same advertising campaign they used in Vietnam. When the Phoenix first arrived in America in the form of Homeland Security, it was advertised as protecting the people from terrorism, just as it was in Vietnam. Any domestic Phoenix-style organization or operation depends on doublespeak and deniability, as well as official secrecy and media self-censorship. The overarching need for total control of information requires media complicity. This was one of the great lessons defeat in Vietnam taught our leaders. The highly indoctrinated and well-rewarded managers who run the government will never again allow the public to see the carnage they inflict upon foreign civilians. Americans never will see the mutilated Iraqi, Afghani, Libyan, and Syrian children killed by marauding U.S. forces and their cluster bombs. On the other hand, falsified portrayals of CIA kidnappings, torture, and assassinations are glorified on TV and in movies. Telling the proper story is absolutely essential. Thanks to media complicity, Phoenix has already become the template for providing internal political security for America's leaders. The process began immediately after 9/11 with the Repressive Patriot Act and a series of presidential executive orders that have since legalized the administrative detention and murder of American citizens said to be involved in terrorism, like Kamal Derwish, killed by a drone strike in 2002, and cleric Anwar al-Awlaki, killed by CIA drone strikes in 2009. Since then, the government has steadily sought to expand its powers to target Americans. In an editorial correction to an article written in 2010 by Dana Priest, The Washington Post said, "The military's Joint Special Operations Command maintains a target list that includes several Americans. In recent weeks, U.S. officials have said that the government is prepared to kill U.S. citizens who are believed to be involved in terrorist activities that threaten Americans." The list of targeted individuals is growing, too, and the intent to kill them is there. As part of the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, the military, no mention is ever made of the CIA, was given the right to administratively detain and assassinate U.S. citizens without due process. Right now, the authorization is ostensibly limited to extraordinary circumstances. But the public is being prepared for the worst. In 2013, Attorney General Eric Holder announced that President Obama has authority to use drone strikes to kill Americans on U.S. soil. The bureaucratic groundwork is being laid as well. Just as Phoenix intelligence operations and coordination centers were established in every province and district in South Vietnam, the Department of Homeland Security has now established fusion centers, and the FBI has established joint terrorism task forces to coordinate representatives from every police, security, military, and civic organization in every state and major city. The fascistic merging of government and corporate forces against the public interest is the most insidious facet of Phoenix in American society. And it is done with the full cooperation of the corporate media, which exploits each and every mass murder we endure, whether it is a terrorist attack or not, like the gay attacker's assault on the gay nightclub in Orlando, to terrorize the public into consenting to greater restrictions on civil liberties and more wars overseas. The success of the Phoenix Doctrine is most evident in the ability of its advocates in the ruling class to corrupt Congress and force it to divert massive amounts of public money into the militarization of foreign and domestic policy. The constant barrage of propaganda about looming terrorist threats and the lurid human rights violations of straw dog enemies abroad serves only to justify heavily armed police officers and National Guardsmen patrolling in paramilitary formations in our airports and train stations. Implicitly, the public knows those weapons can be used against them. Now that the corrupt and corrupting Phoenix institutional structure is firmly in place in America, it is only a matter of time until we enter the next Phoenix phase of explicit terror here at home. Chapter 4. The Systematic Gathering of Intelligence. A census, if properly made and exploited, is a basic source of intelligence. It would show, for instance, who is related to whom, an important piece of information in counterinsurgency warfare, because insurgent recruiting at the village level is generally based initially on family ties. David Galula. As counterinsurgency expert Galula noted over 50 years ago, long before the Internet made it easy for governments and Internet corporations like Google to amass and manipulate private information about individuals, an old-fashioned door-to-door census was an effective basis for the political control of large numbers of persons. So it was in South Vietnam, where in 1962 the CIA implemented its Family Census Program. The Family Census Program was the brainchild of Robert Thompson, a British counterinsurgency expert the CIA hired in 1961 to advise it on population control in South Vietnam. The CIA was still learning the ropes of modern neocolonial repression, and it looked to Brits like Thompson for guidance. Based on his success in suppressing a communist uprising in Malaya, Thompson proposed a three-pronged approach that coordinated military, intelligence, and police agencies in a concerted attack on the underground communist resistance to American rule. Managed by the National Police, the census meant compiling a dossier on every family in South Vietnam. Along with everyone's name and the portrait of the family, the dossier included each person's political affiliation, fingerprints, income, savings, and other relevant information, such as who owned property or had relatives outside the village and thus a legitimate reason to travel. By 1965, there were 7,453 registered families, primarily in Saigon and major cities. The family census dossiers also helped the CIA discover the names of secret Communist Party cell members in GVN-controlled villages. Apprehending these political cadres was then a matter of arresting their associates and softening them up until they informed. The idea was to weaken the insurgency by forcing its political cadres to flee to guerrilla units in rural areas, thus depriving the VCI of leadership in GVN-controlled areas. This was critical to winning the war, for as South Vietnam's President Nguyen Van Thieu once observed, Ho Chi Minh values his two cadres in every hamlet more highly than 10 military divisions. Thompson's three-pronged method was successful, but only up to a point, for many political cadres were not terrorists. As Galula wrote, many were men whose motivations, even if the counterinsurgent disapproves of them, may be perfectly honorable. They do not participate directly, as a rule, in direct terrorism or guerrilla action, and technically have no blood on their hands. Indeed, Thompson's systematic approach created little love for the GVN, as noted in the previous chapter, insofar as innocent people were routinely tortured or extorted by crooked cops. On other occasions, double agents tricked security forces into arresting people hostile to the insurgency. Recognizing these weaknesses, Thompson persuaded the CIA to organize a special police force, Kansat Dak Biet, later known as the Special Branch, within the National Police. The Special Police was to be composed, theoretically, of highly trained interrogators and carefully selected case officers, plainclothes professionals who, like FBI agents, could not be confused.